Greetings. We're now about to begin our study of the second chapter of Megillat Esther. And we are still in the palace, as we see Ahasuerus, after the crisis of Vashti has passed and the resolution based on Memuchan's advice has been taken. And we get a literary marker at the beginning of chapter 2, which somewhat chains with the literary marker at the second verse of chapter 1. Chapter 1 began in the second verse by Yamim Hahem, in those days. After the party, we then get a marker that indicates that we're now, there's a passage of time, but not of significant time, and there's a sequential and causal relationship between the two. As it says, Achar ha-devarim ha'ela, meaning after these things, the next thing that happens is the discussion, the conversation that takes place in the palace that we're about to hear. Important to note that so far what we have read is a series of crises and resolutions. Each resolution leads to another crisis. For instance, the first opening verses hint, as we mentioned in the first lecture, to a crisis of instability, a lack of solid power on the part of Ahasuerus that necessitates, and the resolution to that and the solution is to have these lavish parties that last for 6 months and then for a week, etc., etc. That party leads to a crisis, and the crisis is Vashti's refusals to show up and her disrespecting the king publicly. There's a resolution to that. The resolution to that is Memuchan's advice to have Vashti dethroned in whatever manner, and to have the word publicized. That, of course, now brings a new crisis, and that new crisis is that there is no queen. And that's where we pick up. Achar ha-dvarim ha'ele keshoch chamat ha-melech Ahasuerus. This image is very strong. After these words, as the king's anger subsided. So we get the image now of a king who seethes, who gets angry and really holds on to it and is boiling, and and this anger lasts for a while, and now it's subsided, which means something else, that the his advisors were only able to address that which fit his mood. He was very angry at Vashti, and that's what Memuchan responded to. Raising the issue of a new queen was something that only could happen after the king calmed down. This, of course, is not a great mark in a leader, somebody who is given to fits of anger and nobody can speak to him about what needs to be done until he calms down. And therefore, in these tiny little twists of the word, there is another shot, another barb, another insult at not only the Persian monarchy, but perhaps, as we've posited several times, at human monarchy in general. Zachar et Vashti ve'et asher asata ve'et asher nigzar aleha. So the end of the first verse tells us much more about Ahasuerus, about how he works. He remembered Vashti, he remembered what she did, and he remembered what was decreed concerning her. Now notice how carefully the text selects its words. Vashti did something, but Ahasuerus didn't do anything. Ahasuerus did not act against her. Rather, something was decreed concerning her in the passive voice. This is what we would term passive-aggressive behavior, where Ahasuerus will not take any stand, and we're going to see this throughout the Megillah, that Ahasuerus does not take a position of control and decision-making at any point. Others are always making decisions, and then whenever those decisions play out poorly, then it's a decision that was made, not something that he takes any responsibility for. He was no Harry Truman, and the buck did not stop there. Again, we are much more concerned with the picture of Ahasuerus that the Megillah is attempting to portray, as opposed to a complete historic picture of Xerxes the emperor. Because again, as I mentioned last time, there are many, many components of his kingdom that are left out. The wars that he fought, how he developed the provinces, treaties he may have made, etc. And all sorts of cultural things, because that's not our concern. And so that perspective of his kingdom, which supports the message that we're trying to portray, is that which is highlighted. So now, that was what he remembered, and now he doesn't have a queen. And so now he's got lads around who are serving him, and they speak up, and they say the following: Yivakshu lamelech ne'arot betulot tovot mareh. They should seek out for the king young girls, young maidens who are attractive. I'll read the next verse to see their entire piece of advice and then comment on it. There is much, much to comment here, including, as promised a couple of sessions ago, something that will take us back to the party and how Achashverosh midrashically dealt with Vashti. V'yafkeid ha-melech p'kidim, he should appoint officers, b'chol medinot malchuto, throughout the provinces of his empire. V'yikbetzu et kol na'ara v'tula, they should gather, the officers should gather every young maiden. Tovat mareh, again, a beautiful young maiden, el shushan ha-bira, el beit ha-nashim, bring them into the women's quarters in the fortress, bira means fortress, of Shushan, el yad hege sris ha-melech, Shomer Hanashim, to a particular fellow whose name is Hegei, it's a Persian name, who is Saris, and in this case undoubtedly really is a eunuch, who is Shomer Hanashim, the one who guards the women. Venaton Tamrukehen, and they should have their oil treatments and skin treatments given to them, all of these girls, which means we're bringing in the girls who are most beautiful, and then they're going to have all sorts of treatments done to make them more beautiful. There is much to be said about that phrase, and we will get to it in a moment. The girl who is fine, who the king finds, who finds favor in the eyes of the king, will rule, will sit on the throne in place of Vashti, tachat Vashti. The king was like this advice, and he did it, meaning he ordered it be done. Every phrase in this conversation is laden with implication, with allusion, and we have to remember a very important principle to study Megillat Esther. Every conversation that we read in Megillat Esther is a translation. There is no conversation that takes place in Megillat Esther that originally took place in Hebrew, in the language of the Megillah, and therefore it's a translation which allows the translator, guided by Ruach HaKodesh, guided by the divine inspiration that justifies the inclusion of the book in the Tanakh, to utilize phrases that to the familiar Tanakh reader who knows other books of Tanakh and is reading it in the original will create for that reader allusions, associations, comparisons, contrasts, etc. And we have a whole host of them in these little paragraphs. Let's look at the beginning. The Na'arei HaMelech speak up, and they say, Yivakshu LaMelech Ne'arot Betulot Tovot Mareh. So before we get to the association, let's note that they are suggesting that the king, in order to find a queen, should seek out young maidens. Now in Na'ara, halachically, within the legal corpus of Judaism, that word Na'ara refers to a girl who is pretty much at the onset of womanhood, around the age of 12, 12 and a half. But there is another reason to argue that the girls that are being sought out here are of that age, because as is well known, throughout the ancient world, and even in some parts of the third world today, girls marry at the onset of puberty. There is no adolescence, there is no high school, there is no teenagehood. You go from being a daughter to being a wife to being a mother, and that's pretty much it. And therefore, you would not find an attractive girl, as I described here, you would not find an attractive girl who was still a maiden and still unmarried, who was much older than that age. So that's who they're seeking out. Why are they seeking such a person out? Well, there is one theory that I'd like to suggest, which is that normally a queen would be not selected by some sort of a pageant or a trial. Queens were not selected for romance or for sexuality. They were selected for political associations. Think about the woman that Shlomo married, to create bonds, or that David married, to create bonds between kingdoms by a king or a prince marrying the daughter of another king, and that creates a treaty, that creates a connection. So the most reasonable thing would be for Ahasuerus to seek out some province that he wants to strengthen his ties with, or a king that he wants to create an alliance with, and have the daughter of that potentate be married to him. Instead, he takes what an unusual path, which is to gather girls, regardless of their background, evidently, and to bring them in based on their beauty. Well, it seems that perhaps there is a shift in the policy that has been going on so far. We don't have much information about where Vashti came from, although the rabbis tell us that she was the granddaughter of the Chaldean king Nebuchadnezzar, who destroyed the temple. But Vashti seems to be someone who is seasoned and someone who knows her own way and stands her own ground. Perhaps the king, and perhaps the boys anticipating this, suggest to the king that it's time that he gets somebody much younger, somebody who he can really control. And that may be the thinking behind getting someone who is not of necessarily royal lineage, and also someone who is significantly younger and has not necessarily been groomed and is waiting to marry a king at a slightly older age, but somebody who is a regular 12-year-old girl. We have to keep in mind the age as we read through the story, because that's how old Esther is going to be when she is taken into the palace, and the story will follow from there. All right. Now, the phrasing, Yivakshu l'melech ne'arov betulot tovot mareh, is a phrase that echoes something at the very, very beginning of the Book of Kings. And Chazal, the rabbis, pick up in this in Masachat Megillah and in Midrashei Esther, that when David was old and cold and could not find any warmth, his courtiers suggested that they seek a beautiful young maiden to be his consort. And according to the testimony of the text, Avishag HaShunamit, the beautiful young girl, was brought, and the king never consummated his relationship with her. She remained his consort, and she, as it were, kept him warm. Now, what's significant about this, and what Chazal immediately pick up on, is something that is not mentioned anywhere in the verses, in the Psukim, but it's something that anybody knowing the story of David, and then knowing the story of Ahasuerus, and especially the last chapter, can immediately figure out on his own, which Chazal say it as follows. The text compares these two, the seeking out of a young girl for Ahasuerus to the seeking out of a young girl for David, by using the same phrasing. Imagine the two. And the way they say it is, any mother who hears that David is looking for a consort immediately rushes her daughter to Yerushalayim. Who would not want their daughter to be the consort of even the aging Melech David? On the other hand, any girl who hears that Ahasuerus is looking for a new queen immediately hides her daughter. And we see that from the rest of the psukim here, which is that they say, Yafkeid HaMelech P'kidim, the king has to appoint officers, and they're going to go gather the girls. In other words, it isn't as if the word goes out, the king is looking for a queen, and everyone rushes to Shushan to bring their daughter, because who wants your daughter to be the next Vashti? Whatever happened to Vashti, it wasn't good. And indeed, from the way that the king is described, who wants your daughter to be the queen of this Ahasuerus? And so here, as opposed to David, they have to appoint officers, they have to take girls by force, and that's how later on when we meet Esther, we'll meet in the next year, how it seems that she is taken. So that is one piece of the puzzle. There is yet another piece of the puzzle from V'yafkeid HaMelech P'kidim that goes back to the issue of allusion. I want to take us back to the first chapter. In the middle of the first chapter, the king insisted or requested, and this is the crisis that we're now recovering from in the text, that Vashti come before him b'cheter malchut. As mentioned, well known, the rabbinic approach to this is that Ahasuerus, when he said she should come with her crown, meant only her crown, and she should come naked. And again, we pointed out why that's very difficult to accept in a historic or pshat level, because the king would defeat everything he's trying to work for by having his own queen, she's not a concubine or a consort, she's a queen, come out disrobed. But Chazal are saying, the rabbis are saying this for a very, very important reason, and it's going to help us understand the development of the plot. The way that that Chazal say it is even coarser than what I've just described, and coarser than most people are familiar with. They record a conversation. This is the version in Masachat Megillah, Daf Yud Bet. They record a conversation between the Persian ministers and the Median ministers who are sitting in front of the king. And the Persian ministers say, oh, the most beautiful women are the Persians. And the Median ministers say, the most beautiful women are the Medes. And Ahasuerus pipes up. And of course, this is anachronistic because Ahasuerus in the Persian court would not be sitting with his ministers. He'd be sitting behind a curtain. But nonetheless, he pipes up and says, these are his words, Kli Shani Mishtamesh Bo, the vessel that I use. That's how he's describing his wife. Is not Median and not Persian. She's Chaldean and she's more beautiful than them all. Do you want to see her? They say yes, on condition she comes out naked, and the king then agrees. Now, the rabbis are putting terribly misogynist language into the mouth of Ahasuerus. And where do they get that from? Where do they get the notion that Ahasuerus, for whatever else he may have done or not done, or overlooked, or been oblivious to, or deliberately turned a blind eye, later on in the Megillah, to the decrees, etc., where do they get the idea that he has such a disparaging and such an objectifying attitude towards his own wife? It's very strange. The truth is, it's right in the text. Take a look in Perek Bet, where we are, in verse 3. Yafkeid ha-melech p'kidim b'chol medinot malchuto v'yikpetsu. That's all we need. The king should appoint officers throughout the kingdom, and they should gather. Where are they going to gather? They're going to gather girls. Again, this is language that we know from earlier text. And everyone reading the Megillah, and the author knows this, is familiar with the book of Bereishit. And the book of Bereishit, where the first story of which our story is a piece of, our story is a piece of a genre known as the Jew in the Foreign Court, Mordechai, Nehemiah, Daniel, etc., starts with the most famous Jew in a foreign court, and that is Yosef in the court of Pharaoh. Yosef first comes into the court of Pharaoh as a dream interpreter when he saves Egypt by his interpretation of the dreams of Pharaoh that have to do with the years of plenty and the years of famine. And after he successfully interprets the dreams, he makes the following observation, which is really a piece of advice. In chapter 41, verse 34, he says, "Ayasef farov yafkeid pkidim al haaretz." He should appoint officers throughout the land. Chimesh deretz Mitzrayim b'sheva shnei asava. And he should divide the land up. V'yikbetsu et kol ochel hashanim atavot. And they should gather. They, the officers, should gather all of the food of the good years, bring it together, and then we will have what to save us during the lean years. Why? Why does the author Megillat Esther use the exact same words? V'yafked hamelach pekidim v'yikbetsu. The king should appoint officers and they should gather. Why does he use those exact same words as the translation for what the courtiers said to the king Ahasuerus? I believe that the reason is that the author is trying to subtly tell his knowledgeable audience. In other words, the text, in a translation, out of context of Tanakh, reads as whatever kind of story it reads. But to those who are knowledgeable of Tanakh and who are reading it in the original, it has a whole other inner message, if you will, is the author is sort of winking at his knowledgeable audience and saying, this is what they said, but be aware, by the use of the language, this reflects an attitude. To wit, Ahasuerus' attitude towards his future wife and towards women in general is parallel to Pharaoh's attitude about grain. In other words, women to Ahasuerus are simply a vehicle, simply an intermediary towards another goal. They are not, as to use a famous philosopher's words, he does not have an I-thou relationship with women, but rather an I-it relationship, and perhaps even worse than that. And so I believe that Chazal are picking up on that little nuance and saying, we see that the author who knows Ahasuerus tells us Ahasuerus is a misogynist, and therefore they expand that by putting this conversation about the vessel that he uses being a Chaldean and being more beautiful. And that also fits the timing of asking Vashti to come out, because after he has had 6 months and then 7 days of this fabulous two parties, the climax of the party is to show off his trophy queen, his trophy wife. And then again, there she is now made parallel to the gold and the silver and the curtains and the linen and the inlaid jewels and everything else about his party and the wine without limit. She's another piece of that showing off. And indeed, the same word is used in the beginning of chapter 1 when it describes the parties. It's Behar Oto et Osher Kavod Malchuto, as he is showing off the wealth and the splendor of his kingdom. And then when he calls Vashti, it's Leharot, again the same word, to show off her beauty. So again, she's a piece of the show. And so Chazal are sensitive to this. They pick it up and they expand it by having this conversation between Ahasuerus and his ministers at the party. Back to our text, we now arrive at a very festive, a very beautiful, a very wondrous and exciting pasuk, which is anything but those adjectives, and I'll explain why. I say that it's exciting and enthusiastic because when the reader of the Megillah arrives at Vayas Kain, the last words of verse 4, the whole congregation recites this verse. Ish Yehudi Ayav Shushan Habira. Very exciting. We're introducing our hero Mordechai, and it's all wonderful. The problem is that if we look at the pasuk carefully, we'll see it's anything but wonderful. Ish Yehudi. Let's read the entire verse. Ish Yehudi Ayav Shushan Habira. Ushmo Mordechai Ben Yair Ben Shim Even Kish Ish Yemini. We are only going to meet Mordechai in this section. In the next year, we'll meet Esther, and we're going to follow her through the palace. And the reason for that is because this verse and the next verse, taken together, give us a very startling and stark picture, not only of Mordechai himself, but of the Jewish community in Shushan at the time, which is a necessary background for understanding the events that are starting to unfold and will unfold, beginning in chapter 3. The phrase Ish Yehudi, a Judean man, is immediately picked up by the rabbi. He said, well, how can you call him a man of Yehuda, the tribe of Judah, when at the end of the verse he is described as an Ish Yemini, a man of Binyamin? So the rabbis come up with the various solutions they come up with. He had one parent from Yehuda, one from Binyamin, that the two tribes were claiming Mordechai as their own for different reasons. But the simple explanation of it is that Ish Yehudi does not mean a man of the tribe of Judea. It means a man from the district of Judea. We have to remember that when the Jews were exiled to Babylonia and then now remained there as it became Persia, the non-Jews in the area referred to them, as we find in other books of Second Temple period, as Guvrin Yehudain, Judean men, not because of their tribal affiliation, but because of their regional affiliation. They came from an area that was known as Judea. Indeed, the province in the Persian court was known as Yehud Madinta, Medinat Yehuda, essentially. And so therefore, he's an Ish Yehudi, meaning somebody who comes from Yehuda. Now, although he is from the tribe of Binyamin, and as we read in Ezra Perek Bet, that Ezra chapter 2, that many of the exiles, especially ones who did return immediately, were from the tribe of Binyamin. It was effectively Binyamin and Levi and Judah. So he's called an Ish Yehudi for that reason. However, again, the selection, the choice of the word and the choice of the phrase is very deliberate and very telling. The word Ish Yehudi shows up only one other time in Tanakh, and it shows up in a contemporary book to Megillat Esther a little bit earlier, which is the book of Zechariah. If you take a look at the book of Zechariah, who was a prophet who operated at the time of the rebuilding and dedication of the Second Temple, so that's about 30 years earlier, Zechariah, in the end of the 8th chapter, which is really the end of the Zechariah with which we're familiar, afterwards there's 6 chapters, which are of a very different style, has a prophecy about the end of days or some great time. Says Bayamim Ahem Ashiachziku Asara Nashim Mikol Shanot Hagoyim Mechnaf Ish Yehudi. 10 men from all of the nations will hold on to the garment, to the edge of the garment of an Ish Yehudi, saying, "We want to go with you because we heard God is with you." Shamanu Elohim Machem. Chazal midrashically build this up beautifully to say, in the future, every person is going to have 2,800 people accompanying him when he comes to Yerushalayim, because there'll be 10 from each of the nations. So that's 10 times 70, that's 700, and one on each corner, and 700 for each one of his knafot, of the corners of his garment. So he has 4 corners because of the tzitzit, so that's 2,800. But the simple read of the text is that 10 people are going to grab onto each person and say, "Take us with you, you Ish Yehudi," We want to meet your God. We want to learn about your God. We understand God is with you. It's a beautiful image. But it means that the Ish Yehudi is going to be leading others to Yerushalayim. Take a look in Yeshayahu chapter 2. All the nations are going to come to Yerushalayim because they will say, Ki Mitzion Tetze Torah, that's where the God of Israel teaches and instructs. So here you have an Ish Yehudi in Zechariah who is leading other people to Yerushalayim, to God. And now in our text we have an Ish Yehudi who has left Yerushalayim. And the only mention of Yerushalayim is in the next verse as a place that people leave. And the place that this Ish Yehudi left, and at this point in time, he's doing nothing in the way of leading others to God. I wouldn't say necessarily the opposite, but there's no mention of that at all. So here's a very different kind of Ish Yehudi at this point in the Megillah. Give him a little time, and we will see the character develop. Ish Yehudi Ayah B'Shushan HaBirah. Now, Ushmo Mordechai, his name is very troubling, but we'll start with his ancestral names. Ben Ya'ir ben Shimi ben Kish Ish Shimini. Right, so he's introduced as a member of the tribe of Benjamin. That is very usual. We're accustomed to meeting new characters in Tanakh and being given their tribal affiliation. Usually we're given their name, oftentimes a patronym, father's name, and usually a tribal affiliation. But to be given a father's name, a grandfather's name, and a great grandfather's name is excessive. We rarely see such a lineage. Sometimes we'll see a longer lineage. For instance, in Divrei Hayamim, in Chronicles, when we're told about the singers that David appointed, they're traced all the way back to Jacob. But generally, the lineage is short. But here, the lineage is too long to be short and way too short to be long. It's very unclear why we have a lineage going back three generations. So we have essentially three options in interpreting this verse. Option number one is that we're being told simply who his father, his grandfather, and his great-grandfather were, in which case the question, the text begs the question, why are we giving two more generations than usual? The second possibility is to say that we're not giving father, grandfather, and great-grandfather, but rather an ancestor, an earlier ancestor, and an earlier ancestor, in which case the question is, why are these three picked? And the obvious answer would be, because they're three very important people, and we're trying to show that Mordechai comes from these great people. The only problem is that they're not great people, meaning they might be great people, but we never heard of them. We never heard of Yair outside of this context. Shim'i, which is a name that appears in another character who's a terrible character in the tribe of Benjamin, the one who kicks the dirt at David and accuses him of being a bloodthirsty man who is getting his just dues when his son Avshalom rebels against him in the second book of Samuel, chapter 15, is a terrible guy. Now, evidently, Shimi is a common Benjaminite name because here we have another Benjaminite named Shimi, but it's hardly likely that Mordechai is going to want to associate him with that Shimi. Besides which, if that was the case, then somebody's living a whole real long time, because David lived a good 550 years before the events in the Megillah, and so if Shimi is Mordechai's grandfather, then that's pretty strange. The third character, Kish, is a name that we're familiar with. And Kish was a good guy. Kish is the father of the king Shaul. But if that's the Kish we're referring to, then if Mordechai is directly descended from Shaul, in other words, not through some other son of Kish, so say Ben Shaul. There, you got a name that's really important. If, on the other hand, he's descended through, let's say, some other son of Kish, then, or child of Kish, then you would say Kish Avi Shaul, Kish the father of Shaul. But instead, and again, you have the problem with Kish having lived hundreds of years earlier. So you have difficulty in interpreting this as being three disparate generations of ancestors going all the way back, as opposed to being directly his father, his grandfather, and his great-grandfather. There's a third possibility, which Chazal homiletically pick up on, which is to say that all of these names are not really names of ancestors, but really these are pseudonyms for Mordechai. That Mordechai was a Ben Yair, Ben Sheheir, Einehem Shel Yisrael, Bitfilato. He enlightened, I brought light to Am Yisrael. God heard his words, Shimi, he Kish al Deitei Shemaim, he knocked on the door of heaven. Beautiful, beautiful imagery, but that's certainly not pshat. It's very hard to say that Mordechai is being described as the son of, and the grandson of, and the great-grandson of, and none of them are real people. So that's one problem, is who are these? Why have we have a lineage going back three generations? The second problem is one of dating. The next verse says, Asher hoglam Yerushalayim im hagola asher hoglata im yechonya melech Yehuda. So we have Mordechai, the son of Yair, the son of Shimi, the son of Kish. And then we say, who was exiled with the exile that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babel, exiled, the exile of Yechoniah, which took place in the year 597 BCE. And again, operating with standard chronology, this verse becomes very difficult, because the way that it's conventionally read is that Mordechai himself was exiled from Yerushalayim. And if that's the case, then Mordechai is a very old man at this point, because these events are taking place 115 years after the exile of Yehoiachin. And if Mordechai himself was adult enough to be considered an exile, not taken along with his parents, then that makes him 140 or something at this point, which we're not given his age, but he's certainly not presented as an extremely old man in the story. And so therefore, that is also difficult. There's a third difficulty in this verse, and what we will do is simply tie all three difficulties together and come up with an answer that should clarify and satisfy all of our problems. The name Kish, we know to be a Jewish name, whatever the source may be, but we know, like Shaul's father's name is Kish. Shimri is related to the word Shomea, Nishma, somebody who listens, somebody who's heard, somebody who's disciplined, whatever it may be. Yair is a beautiful Jewish name. It's a name that appears among other families of Rachel. There's Yair HaGiladi from the tribe of Manasseh. So these are fine Jewish names. What kind of name is Mordechai? Well, the answer is, painfully, that Mordechai is not a very Jewish name. It's a pagan name, and it's associated, this is well documented, it's associated with the pagan god Marduk, the god of creation. This is a not uncommon phenomenon that Jews, after being in a foreign environment which welcomes them, after a number of years, start taking on some of the names and mannerisms, etc., of the local population. Evidently, in this case, it's not much different. Chazal pick up on this in a particular way when in a comment on a later conversation that takes place between between Ahasuerus and Haman. Ahasuerus says to Haman, when Haman presents in chapter 6 the beautiful description of the parade he wants for himself, then Ahasuerus says, go and do this for Mordechai HaYudi HaYishev B'Shar HaMelech. And so the rabbis expand on that and they say, what happened? He said, go do it for Mordechai. And Haman said, there's a lot of Mordechais. Marduk's a common name. So he said, Mordechai HaYehudi. And so Haman answers, well, there's a lot of Marduks or Mordechais among the Jews. He said, Yoshev B'Shar HaMelech, the one who's sitting by the palace gates. But that tells you that the name is not an uncommon name among Jews, which itself is somewhat of a sad statement. Now, of course, after this story, and Mordechai turns out to be a hero, so the name Mordechai becomes a, if you will, a sanitized, beautiful Jewish name, which was held by many, many great people throughout history. However, at this point, that's not the case with the name. So how do we put all of this together? One bit of sociological data will help us, and that is that the phenomenon, and it's one that we experience, that we see today in front of our own eyes in America, is that the phenomenon of assimilation in a country that allows Jews to become part of the population, and it's quite clear that Jews in Persia were assimilated. This is what Chazal say about their participation in the party. It's quite clear from the fact that when 47 years after the destruction, they were allowed to go home. Very few of them went home, and obviously these people didn't go home. They're still in Persia. That whenever that happens, there is a process that takes place over several generations of acculturation, which, just think about the difference of people who came to Ellis Island and ended up in the Lower East Side in the first or second decades of the 20th century, who were not necessarily committed to religion, but were culturally very Jewish. And they spoke Yiddish, and their entire framework was a Jewish framework. And what happened to the next generation of their kids, who were the ones who taught them English and who helped them around the country, but their kids themselves had very Jewish names and very Jewish environments, but two generations later, they're intermarried. Because the process moves on. I mean, it's very sad, but of course, without a very strong environmental association with Limud HaTorah, with studying the Torah and with religion, then that's pretty inevitable. As a course, a matter of course, and it's something, of course, we're all very pained by, but that's what happens. So here you have three beautiful Hebrew names, followed by the next generation is a fellow with a name that doesn't fit at all. So let's put it all together. The reason that the lineage goes back to Kish is because Kish is the one who was exiled. Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish ish Shemini Asher Hogla Yerushalayim. Who's Asher Hogla? Kish was Hogla. And now we understand that three generations later, it's about 115 years later. That fits the length of a generation pretty well, about 40 years. And now there's Mordechai, who is now a third generation Babylonian. And as we see in front of our eyes, that in a welcoming environment as existed there, not in a hostile environment like Eastern Europe, but in a welcoming environment, by the third generation, the acculturation is very, very strong. And there you already have a name that is a locally accepted name, and perhaps even a name with religious overtones. Now we also understand why the lineage goes back three generations. We understand the change in the name. And all of our questions have been answered, because we've also solved the chronology, and we understand that this is not Mordechai who was exiled, but rather it was his ancestor Kish, and again, Yair, Shimi, and Kish are simply his father, his grandfather, and his great-grandfather, who we need to connect in order to associate him back to Yerushalayim. Everyone should have a wonderful Shabbos, and Mirtz Hashem on Monday we will continue this year by our meeting Esther, the heroine, who will appear for us in Pasuk Zion, and we will get most of the way through chapter 2 in the next shiur. Shabbat Shalom.